everyone. Welcome to Shifting the Paradigm with your host, Rian Bevan. That is me. I'm here. We're finally doing another episode. There's going to be more of these coming up finally, which is great. School's getting to a close. So yeah. Anyways, we've really entered some interesting times happening in the history of the world. I mean, looking back far enough, you can trace the roots of most civilizations to the use of some kind of psychedelic plant use. The Greeks had the Eleusinian mysteries. There was the Soma medicine of India, Amrita of Buddhism, and so many different indigenous plant medicine use from so many cultures around the world. But for the most part, today, we seem way far removed from our roots of dabbling in these mysteries of consciousness. But worldwide, many of these plants have been banned completely beyond even the ability for scientific inquiry. But today we're seeing a huge increase of substances like psilocybin mushrooms, LSD, and ayahuasca. Like, I think to the point that this generation is beyond the use of it back in the 60s and 70s. It's things are changing, and science increasingly as well has started to look to understand the possibilities of these compounds. What can they be useful for? We're seeing significant improvements to many problems affecting people with these, like depression, anxiety, PTSD. We can treat trauma and addiction and even like substance use disorders, which is really important with obviously the ongoing opioid epidemic right now. And so the results of these new studies are really making changes in general medical understandings. Really, it's some of the most interesting research going on right now, I think, but that's just me. What's more is these compounds can even help us feel much more deeply situated in nature and connected to the environment around us. They have potential in increasing the psychological trait of openness by quite a few points, which is something thought to more or less solidify as you grow older. So this connection to nature and openness to experience and to others, to other ways of being, to other cultures, with this conflict and tension going on in the world right now, we need any and all of these allies that we can find to put us back on the right track, to help us heal from our collective traumas and work together with each other and the earth so we can actually survive the global issues facing us. And in that way, it's understandable that so many of us are flocking to countries like Peru or elsewhere in order to experience some of these substances. Our modern society is so devoid of myth and lore, it's so lacking in connection to nature that it's no surprise that so many of us are looking towards indigenous cultures in order to find something that they feel is missing in today's world. But this has had huge effects on the lives of entire regions and cultures. These sacred medicines are suddenly part of an economic system and given commensurate value. Many are profiting from this commercialization, especially in big tourist hubs like Iquitos in Peru. But cultures are rapidly changing to cater to this new industry, and we have to really put awareness on these issues that can arise, because there's a lot of ways that this can be seen as further ways of neo-colonial violence, with a lot of exploitation of cultures occurring. This is resulting in unsafe practices and dangerous potentials in many of these places, and many villages nearby, with nearby tribes, they're losing youth and healers to be able to go and participate in this new economic system, but many of them aren't going back, and these regions can be suffering in many cases. If we're going to deal with the problems facing us collectively on the planet, we can't do that by just seeking some kind of healing and giving our own problems to these cultures. We have to find new ways to work together and create a reciprocal system that can support and empower each other. When we go down and promote or engage in shamanic tourism, it's often just the goal of the tourist is to go and experience the shamanic drug. But we have to realize, like, for these cultures themselves, this exists in a context of the culture, in a reason for doing these ceremonies. And when you just focus on the shamanic tourism drug aspect of it, you're really taking the balance away from these cultures and the reason that this is working for them for so long historically. But a lot of organizations are working to support and empower many of these groups. Lots of organizations are starting to work this way in grassroots ways with these indigenous groups to support the people, plants, and stories associated. So that brings me to my guest today, Chris Casus. Chris has been doing work in this way, supporting some indigenous communities. And a big part of this is a project with the Mazatec community of Jautla de Jimenez in Oaxaca, Mexico. So he's been working to support families and the community in the area. And a big part of this is celebrating the history of the culture. They need to be able to understand where their culture comes from and be able to celebrate that. so that in the view of the world, they can be proud. He's working on a Mazatec archival project, which aims to be the most comprehensive history of the culture. And I believe he told me that one of the leads in the project is related to Maria Sabina. Many of you know of the history of mushrooms in the world. If you don't, Maria Sabina is someone that's interesting to look up. He's also done work in Peru, supporting a community with the creation of a community center and a ceremonial space. And there's going to be some more work there. I'm not exactly sure. Spending a lot of time traveling between these two countries and his home in the States, Chris has been working to bring a deeper understanding of these indigenous cultures to the Western mind. I've heard some rumblings of the possibility of bringing one of the old Mazatec curanderas that he works with to the States to do some talks from her own perspective and her indigenous voice, which is so often overlooked in much of today's society. And this episode is partially brought to you by my school homework as well. I do want to get Chris back on the show when I can and have a more wide-ranging conversation, because he's a heck of an interesting guy. He's great. I was doing a long paper on shamanic drug tourism in Latin America this semester, so this conversation stays mostly within these kind of ideas. But now with school being over and graduation finally in sight, I'm hoping to be able to do this show way more frequently. So thank you all for listening. Please subscribe too, so that if you want to catch an episode and it's been a little while, like since the last one, it'll just pop up and you won't have to worry about hoping that you catch one of these when it gets released. I also apologize about my mic quality in the conversation. I had a few technical bumps when I was trying to set this up, and I was sick when I talked to Chris. So sorry for the sniffles. But anyways, onto the episode. Thank you for tuning in, and we'll talk to you soon.
Okay, sweet.
Excellent. So, Huautla de Jimenez.
De Jimenez. Okay, cool. So I thought it was something like that, but my Spanish is not good at all.
Right?
Do you speak like fluent Spanish? So when you're down there, it's like easy for communication, or is it kind of difficult to get?
No, the answer to that question is no. my Spanish is not, I wouldn't call it fluent. It's a little better than functional. So I would say I'm like 70% there in terms of fluency. Yeah, I need to do like some systematic study, and I really need to like sit down and do it. And then my fluency would probably grow exponentially. Yeah.
Just like in a place like Huautla, or if it's in the area in Peru that you were working, is it a lot of people who have like those kind of pidgin languages between Spanish and their tribal languages, or is it a lot of just fluent Spanish speakers?
A lot of fluent Spanish speakers. Everyone pretty much speaks Spanish, but when they're in their kind of indigenous homeland, they'll just speak the indigenous language.
Okay.
I think more so in Peru, up in the mountains, they speak Quechua.
Mm-hmm.
In Huautla, the elders often will speak Mazatec. The younger generation either does or doesn't know it, and many of them don't know it.
Oh, that's interesting.
Spanish. But some of the elders, this is kind of interesting, do not speak Spanish in Huautla.
Okay.
Yeah.
So they might like supplement and say like a Spanish word, but not actually use Spanish as their main language.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. Natalia doesn't speak Spanish.
Mm-hmm.
She knows the prayers in Spanish because the prayers, ostensibly she learned them in the Catholic Church, so they're in Spanish.
Mm-hmm.
But she herself, she'll like every once in a while she'll say a Spanish word or phrase, but you can tell she actually doesn't like to speak Spanish.
That's interesting. Is it because like I guess she's able to do deeper meaning of what she wants with Mazatec, but like is the Mazatec a language that has a ton, like I know with English it's very subject object and you can explain stuff in kind of detail, but it's not as it's not like French or something like that where you have the female or male kind of pronoun in front of it. Is Mazatec kind of like, yeah, like I just don't know a lot about the language, so it's kind of interesting.
So I don't speak Mazatec. I only know what I hear about it translated from to English from Spanish most of the time. And, you know, my Spanish is okay. I get along. But what I've been told is, yeah, that there's domains of kind of meaning in Mazatec that don't really translate.
Okay, interesting.
And, yeah, that makes sense. That makes sense. So she, Natalia, she prays in Spanish. She does the sort of more traditional Catholic prayers, the Ave Maria, the Our Father in Spanish. But then she does a whole set of prayers in Mazatec.
In Mazatec.
And we have to get translations to understand what she's saying.
Do you find that, like, because she's speaking Spanish, or, sorry, Mazatec, is it hard for communication, or does it almost allow you to actually do more deep listening into what her intention is?
You know, there's a challenge. There's definitely a challenge in it. So one thing, you know, one thing's clear with Natalia in her prayers, there's something in her intonation, and one of these days we're going to record it and we'll do transcriptions and the whole thing. But in terms of her intonation, there's something very unique, and it's hard to describe.
Yeah.
There's a sort of an authenticity, a sincerity. And I think I've mentioned this before. It's almost like she's waking up the effigies. Like, she's very deliberate and kind of talking to them and speaking with them. But as far as, you know, sometimes you're in the last velada I did up there, we took a really big pile of derumbes, and I was totally blown out, totally depersonalized. And, you know, I had moments where I would kind of come into the room and I would look around and go, wow, this is weird. Like, there's a woman speaking an indigenous language that's then translated into Spanish and then is translated to English. And it's like, wow, this is wild. You know, how did we end up here?
Yeah, I guess in that medicine state too, it's like, oh man, like you get to really see the processes that allow all of this to have happened. That's fascinating. So, I'm kind of like curious, and I do have a recording now, so I'll do it kind of more freeform. But I was kind of curious, what kind of got you involved in this kind of work? I know you were doing a like research with your psychology work for a long time, and then you kind of got more involved in actual working with the traditions themselves. So I'm just wondering how did that all come about?
Yeah, so as far as the mushroom goes, you know, I first developed kind of a direct relationship with the mushroom when I was really young. And the doorway for me was actually through kind of exposure to the Mazatec tradition. So I was in the library one day and I was going through books and I came upon this set of photographs. Basically depicted the velada that Maria Sabina did for Gordon Wasson. So I shortly thereafter found mushrooms and started eating them. I was young. I was, you know, 13. So I early on had that kind of direct intuitive connection to Mazatec tradition. And
that's definitely not the case for most people who are getting into mushrooms to actually start with that kind of deeper understanding.
It was definitely unique. I'll put it that way. But I didn't go out there until I think it was 8 years ago. So I'm 40 now. So I was 32 when I first went out there. And I was actually out there for like 9 months. I was out there a really long time. And I was in Mexico for a year. So that's how that got going. And then shortly thereafter, I became involved with the Native American Church. I went up to the North Dakota Reservation, Pine Ridge, and was doing peyote work there. And then, I don't know, a year or two after that, went to Peru. and did the kind of ayahuasca thing. Yeah. That timeline may not be perfectly correct, but it's something like that, you know.
Were you up in like the Andes where you're doing some of the work, or where you have done some of the work, or was it in a totally different area than you've kind of gone back to?
You know, we were up in the Andes.
Okay.
Trip. We went up to the Andes, and then we were also in the jungle around Iquitos. Mm-hmm. When we were in the Andes, the medicine scene was a little different. It wasn't so, it's grown a lot.
Okay.
And I wasn't doing Huachuma when I was up there that first time.
Okay.
So the last time I went, we were getting into the Huachuma pretty, frequently.
Yeah. Interesting. I just totally lost my train of thought. I was going to ask something. So with that, then, like, a lot of people who are engaging in this kind of tourism, obviously they're more coming down to a place like Jautla or to different areas of Peru, just wanting to have an authentic indigenous experience or something like that. But from, I guess, your time in going down to these places, have you noticed, a shift in the cultures themselves from this kind of industry starting to crop up around? Because I know previously with, at least in Jautla, with Maria Sabina, that was like Bob Dylan started going down there, and I think Jim Morrison and all this stuff, and it created quite a big boom and had some level of negative effects. But what's that kind of... what's that change been for you that you've seen, especially, I guess, doing this Mazatec archival research project?
Right.
Yeah, you probably have a purview into this.
The situation is different in Peru compared to what's going on in Jautla. Mm-hmm. So some of it is Peru is a tourist destination outside of, you know, medicine work and that sort of thing.
Yeah.
So places like the Sacred Valley have a lot of their economy, the bulk of their economy is rooted in tourism and has been for, I don't know how long, mm-hmm. Machu Picchu and the whole thing.
Exactly.
So, you've got this kind of, with the Sacred Valley in Peru, you've got the central Sacred Valley that's leading up towards Machu Picchu. Mm-hmm. And then just a tourism mecca. If you get a little outside of that main sort of valley area, it becomes more indigenous. And not mm-hmm. a lot of people are going up to these areas.
Okay.
The cultures are relatively intact in a sense. Most people, including the young people, speak Quechua. So there's that. Now, at the same time, they want economic opportunities. So they mm-hmm. kind of fight the tourism up because they know it means economic opportunities.
Yeah.
So that's kind of the situation up there. And it seems like it's, you know, it's okay. In Iquitos, things have gone kind of apeshit.
Yeah. Cause that's the central hub of both the drug tourism and general tourism for that, region of Peru, I guess. Right.
Yeah. Yeah. And it just, the ayahuasca thing kind of, subsequent to the media explosion after this psychedelic renaissance phenomenon started to develop, really, people started to kind of pour into Iquitos. And now it's just, psychedelic tourism to the max. So mm-hmm. I'm a little turned off by, you know, Iquitos. There've been problems in Pucallpa recently. Mm-hmm. There was the, you know, the Canadian that went out there and that whole scene.
Kind of interesting. I was in a class the other semester, and I mentioned that I was interested in researching some of this stuff. And one of my friends from that class grew up with that guy, Sebastian, who ended up possibly murdered. Yeah, so it's kind of interesting to be in an area right nearby where that guy was from.
Yeah.
See, like, the Canadian, oh no, this happened, versus, like, the indigenous side of things. Were you in Peru during all that happening?
Yeah, I actually was. We were actually working briefly. I only did a couple of ayahuasca sessions, but we were doing ayahuasca with one of her nephews. when that happened. So yeah, it was, I mean, just crazy and dark and sad. Yeah. A cautionary tale in terms of how to sort of not go about this.
Yeah, because
go ahead.
I was gonna say it's kind of interesting, like that. Like one of the obvious kind of problems, I guess, with the amount of tourism of this sort going down is like sham shamans and the unsafe practices around that. But I guess a lot of what doesn't get talked about is the like neo-colonial, like settler colonial violence that ends up being perpetrated, not even necessarily in an aware way, but just from this kind of rich people going down and trying to have an authentic indigenous experience.
Yeah. 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 A lot of it has to do with sort of the unique nature of our culture and its particular trauma. Mm-hmm. So people, you know, often are carrying these traumatic patterns or psychopathological patterns, and they're not conscious. So they take them down to places like Peru, and they're working with these cultures. And the risk is, if you're not careful, that you can leave traces of that trauma in the cultures. Mm-hmm. So that's obviously what happened with this Sebastian guy. He had something going on deeper. There were mental health issues that weren't being addressed, and it blew up. So, yeah. So that's the situation in Peru. In Huautla, you know, the tradition is only just now getting comfortable to the point that they're more willing to open up a little bit about it. Now, it's still very guarded. And Mazatec in general are a little more guarded. Some of it has to do with what happened in the 60s. You know, there was this influx of hippies. Mm-hmm. And they didn't really know how to interface with the culture respectfully. Yeah. So, you know, even Natalia, it's sort of funny, like we'll do a velada, and then at the end, you know, when it's time for her to go, she'll look at us and be like, all right, boys, you know, don't go anywhere. You just sit here in front of the altar. And because they've had gringos, you know, freak out and get naked and go running through the streets, which to the Mazatec is a big no-no. Like,
you
do it that way.
Especially with the altar as, I guess, that central piece, that is where your attention's focused on, not on making crazy drama outside of that.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah, the altar's a big part of the tradition and how they do it. Mm-hmm. So they're getting, you know, they're getting a little more open about it. And they were certainly more open with us. What it really requires, particularly with the curanderos, is you have to sit down and eat a bunch of mushrooms with them. And then once you do that and they see that you can hold yourself, mm-hmm. They open up a little more, you know? And so, yeah.
So I guess in that, it's kind of like you have to meet the culture at like a meeting spot before they're just going to allow you to understand some of their like indigenous understandings, so that they're not just getting these Westerners running amok everywhere.
Yeah. Yeah. You know, there's in terms of what they do in the curanderismo, you know, the Mazatec tradition, it's, you know, you can tell, particularly with the older ones, they've been doing it a long time. There are subtleties to it. Mm-hmm. And, you know, they, depending on kind of how things go, they'll open up. Mm-hmm. Now, generally, what we observed is they open up during the velada.
Okay.
They'll open up, you know, a couple of hours in, and they'll start, like in the case of Natalia, start sharing stories. And the amusing thing is, a lot of the stories that would come out were stories that even her grandchildren, who would be present, had never heard.
Oh.
So there's I don't want to say a divide, but there's something that the elders in that tradition are carrying that they don't even necessarily share with their children and grandchildren.
And is this like cultural, like myth and cosmology, or is this more like history of the Mazatec going back to like the 60s and that kind of thing?
You know, the stories are kind of, it can be any number of things. Mm-hmm. One of the stories that Natalia told that her granddaughter had never heard was about there were these entities or these deities that she talked about that she had seen that, that would protect springs, so the natural springs up in the mountains. And it really contains a perception that's part of the wisdom tradition.
Yeah.
But that's, I would say, kind of more mythology or cosmology. And then, of course, you know, there's just stories about the town and things that have happened and stuff like that, and stories from childhood and that sort of thing.
So I guess, like, with that, what is a little bit of just the history of that area? I know that there was, I don't know a ton of the Maria Sabina stuff beside the fact that like Argord and Wasson went there, mushrooms came to the West, people started going there. But what was the change of scene like when Huatla was just like that in itself and then became this tourist destination? Like how much did that change the culture there?
You know, I, prior to Wasson, truth of the matter is there isn't much in the way of recorded history of the Mazatec. Now, that archival project we're working on and the individual we're working on in regards to that has almost, you know, a near encyclopedic knowledge of history going back to that level. But at this, you know, up to this point, for example, we really don't know anything about, for example, their calendar. Mm-hmm. So our, you know, the person we're doing this project with does have a whole section of his archive just devoted to the calendar. But for years, up until recently, people would ask about it and they would more or less pretend like it didn't exist. Interesting, you know, interesting in its own right.
Yeah.
But as far as, you know, the Mazatec people are concerned, they're, Nahua derived. So their language is part of the, you know, the Nahua complex, and most of the story we get is post Wasson.
Okay.
So, you know, Wasson shows up in 1954 and does the Velada, publishes the Time Life article, and then people start going out there.
Mm-hmm.
And at this point in time, it's, I think it's the second largest town in Oaxaca. I don't know. I don't remember.
Oh, wow.
After Oaxaca, it's fairly developed. You know, there's more things up there now, like drains, which they didn't have even 10 years
ago. Wow.
Yeah.
And that's due to such an influx in tourism that they had to start doing this, or just the globalized nature of the world now has kind of triggered that?
You know, in all honesty, the tourism situation up there is pretty toned down.
Okay.
Some of it is that it's difficult to get out there.
Mm-hmm.
It's remote. You have to be pretty motivated to get out there. You know, you take a bus on a really windy road, backcountry road, and you know, when I was there this summer, you know, you'd be walking around. And you could go a week and not see another gringo. And then when you see the gringo, you definitely see the gringo.
Yeah.
You know exactly what they're up there for.
Yeah.
But as far as the tourism situation goes, it's a little more toned down. I think that it was this last year or the year prior, they were recognized as what they call a Puebla Mágica in Mexico. So it's like a designation that ultimately probably will attract more in the way of tourism.
Does that just mean like a cultural heritage area? What yeah. is that designation?
Yeah. Okay. Yeah. Like places like San Luis Potosi and
yeah.
you know, other places like that.
Interesting. So, yeah, I guess not necessarily like UNESCO heritage site, but of a distinction similar to that. Okay.
Yeah.
Fascinating. So I guess like with what you're saying of like, you don't see a gringo for a while. And then when you do, you understand why they're there. I guess a lot of Westerners who would be going into an area like that for the mushroom tradition, they might really just see the mushroom as, oh, it's a mushroom. It's a drug that you take and you can have spiritual healing. And most people would not have had the insight of you at 13 years old, reading a book about this kind of stuff. So while in our or like Westerner purview, it might look more like something that's just a drug that can facilitate a change of consciousness and some sort of healing, what do the Mazatec have a view of what this is in itself?
Yeah, I mean, the mushroom, and it's really kind of well, it's a function of doing the velada, a function of understanding the chants, also, you know, the material on Maria Sabina. So, for example, the Alvaro Estrada book and Wasson, to a certain degree, give some sense of how they view it. But for them, it's, you know, it's obviously a sacrament. It's also used in the context of healing. And they view it as personified and conscious. So when they're talking about the mushroom, they talk about the santitos, or the little saints, which is really referring to the kind of dynamic living spiritual presence inside of it that comes alive during the velada. And they also refer to it as, you know, the blood of Christ, or the little ones that live in the forest. So they really view it as alive, as a sacrament. And a lot of ways, they kind of view it as part of the family. So,
interesting, yeah. Does the Mazatec culture, like, stem from some kind of Mayan culture as well? Because I know during the Mayan times, it was like Tan. I don't know how to say it at all, so I don't even want to butcher it. But they would call it flesh of the gods. Is this kind of like a culture that has been derived from Mayan culture?
Yeah. You know, it's not real clear. And I actually don't know the specific background. Like I said, you know, the Mazatec are Nahuatl derived, and we know that from their language.
Yeah.
As to the relationships between the Nahuatl and the Aztec and the Maya, I'm not entirely certain. I'm not entirely certain what the common root is, but ostensibly there is a common root. And, you know, the earliest records we have of mushroom use go back to the coronation of Moctezuma II. So there was a friar, or I don't know, he was a religious figure, priest of some sort, recorded that there were mushrooms being used at his coronation. So that's kind of the earliest record we have of it, but we don't have much information prior to that.
Interesting.
Now, I mean, I speculate that the use of mushrooms, or an awareness of the use of mushrooms, probably goes all the way back to the Athapascan migration from Siberia, because they use mushrooms in the Siberian tradition. So, you know, I don't know. But it's all speculation, and I don't know that we'll ever have a clear picture of precisely how that happened.
Yeah, it's just, I guess, more of an understanding of associations of culture without actually not ever being able to understand what the direct line of it would be.
Yeah.
That's fascinating. Yeah. So, but before I get into asking you about kind of more of the actual work that you're doing in Jautla and in Peru, I'm just wondering, like, what are some of the, I want to ask about kind of positives and negatives, both for the cultures themselves and for the tourists who go down there, and like changes. Cause you did mention like a lot of people with kind of socio or psychopathology go down there. So that can have obviously some kind of inflammatory possibilities for the person. So I'm just wondering, like, yeah, what are some of the negatives and positives you see for both sides of people in these kind of regions with this drug tourism?
Yeah, I mean, as far as the people who are attracted, and I'm speaking more generally to psychedelic experience, and we've talked about this a little bit recently, there does seem to be a preponderance of people specifically with cluster B pathologies. And then, of course, people who are dealing with more like the bread and butter of psychopathology, which is anxiety and depression and things like that. So there's a risk to people who do these psychedelics in general that they're going to take something that's actually going to aggravate and magnify the expression of psychopathology. And the deeper risk is really in types of psychopathology where it can aggravate psychotic features. So people can become disassociated and psychotic. Now, that's the exception, and it's rare. It's rare, but it does, you know, it does happen. As far as people going down to places like Huautla, you know, when it comes to things like sociopathy, we haven't ran into too many sociopaths down there.
Okay.
They tend to, I think they tend to be more kind of interested in like party culture.
Yeah.
They're more, because there's more, for a sociopath, there would be more targets.
Yeah, more connection and vulnerability of the people around them instead of culture. So, that really not, you know, able to
like, Dunya Natalia is like no nonsense. She's pretty fierce. And she's kind of not going to put up with some of the bullshit.
Yeah.
At the same time, she's, you know, this tiny little Mazatec grandmother. Occasionally what's happened, and it's been rare from what I understand, two times she's had it, where a Westerner kind of freaks out. And in both cases afterwards, they were actually really repentant and it was okay. Everything worked out. Mm-hmm. But like, for example, she had a ceremony and I just, having sat through veladas, I go, oof, where one of the participants got up and smashed the Jesus.
Oh.
I just, in terms of the velada, I'm like, oh God, please don't smash the Jesus. That's the last thing you want to do.
Because that is, you know, like one of the central things on their altar is like that and the Our Lady of Guadalupe, I guess.
Yeah. Oh. So I'm sure it was not appreciated.
Yeah.
So, you know, there's that risk with people kind of, you know, freaking out and having adverse reactions, and the Mazatecs are actually pretty wary, and they get nervous when people start having that kind of experience. They're not really used to it. So, you know, there's that risk. You know, there's the risk in a place like Huautla that it could go the road of a place like Iquitos, where the whole tradition is basically co-opted by profit seeking and that sort of thing.
Yeah, actually, I was pretty surprised that you said that it was kind of toned down in Huautla compared to much of Peru, just because of what the history was with Maria Sabina and such. I thought it would be more of a happening area, I guess, in terms of retreat centers and Western presence. But so it's kind of interesting that it still remained.
Since, you know, there aren't actually any retreat centers. There's zero. And the reason for that is at least the elders are actually pretty serious about that tradition. And one of the rules is you don't charge.
Yeah.
You don't charge for velada. The velada is a donation only. And anyone who doesn't remain faithful to that principle of the velada is really viewed as a charlatan.
Okay.
That's the word they use, charlatan, and it's, you know, it's a big no-no. So you can't really set up a retreat center because you're not going to be able to sustain it.
Exactly. Oh.
Yeah.
Oh, I love that. It kind of makes it so that it's not, it doesn't make it part of commensurate value, and it always stays way closer to what the tradition is in itself. And that's what I think I find quite interesting about something like, this area, is the understanding of it as this really central piece to their cosmovision or their religion, rather than so many people going down to ayahuasca to have just a life transformative experience with indigenous people. It seems like it's maintained a little bit more of the traditional context to it.
Yeah, it has. I think taking a step back and thinking about it objectively, having seen all of these different traditions, that's definitely been part of what's always been so endearing to me about Mazatec tradition, is its fidelity to that. The way I think of it is sacred history, which is really cosmology.
Yeah.
And the way they've maintained a direct connection to that, because that's very rare.
Yeah. Because it usually, like, right when Westerners start making an industry in an area, it rapidly changes the culture around it. So that's really interesting. In contrast, then, in an area like Peru, what are the kind of changes that you've seen associated in some of the areas that you've been doing work with the tourism?
So there, you know, there are different regions and they're impacted by it, to different degrees. You know, as far as the Huachuma tradition goes, archaeological evidence suggests that it kind of derives from the Chavin culture up in the north. And we went up there, and it's more like Huautla up there. There is not as much tourism, but there's a trickle of it. So far as I understand, like, the history of it was kind of interrupted. So you had the Chavin culture and then it vanished. And then you have this effort to kind of resurrect it in terms of Huachuma. So, you know, that's its own sort of thing. And it's pretty good. You know, it's a source of income for locals out there. You know, the Sacred Valley, like I said, is, you know, places like Pisac have really blown up in terms of medicine culture in the last 10 years. So even compared to when I was out there last time, there's a lot more going on out there. Like, there's more people doing jape. That wasn't there 10 years ago.
Okay.
I mean, there's always been coca chewing in the Sacred Valley, but now they have like mambe, which tended to be more regional to the jungle area.
Yeah,
so that's up there. And then you have also this like kind of burgeoning interest in Huachuma, and you also have a lot of ayahuasca going on up there, which was not the case 10 years ago. And the ayahuasca scene compared to the other medicines is a little weirder to me. They're just doing it in a very different way than the traditional way. So
interesting. So it seems like that kind of area, because of the tendency towards just medicine culture wanting to form, it started to almost take on its own syncretic medicine space. Is that kind of what's going on?
Yeah. And there are, you know, it's complex. The complexity is on kind of all sides of the equation. So far as I understand, historically, there wasn't a Huachuma tradition in the Sacred Valley. Now, there's some indication that they may have been doing something like up at Apurao Sangate, which is in the south. It's like 4 hours south of the Sacred Valley. And that there was a Huachuma tradition there. And there's some suggestion that it may have been more prevalent than we know.
Okay.
But they're adopting it up there. And much like what happened with the Native American church, the adoption of Huachuma is kind of viewed as a source of strength and solidarity amongst locals. So, for example, the Huachumero we're working with has 24 female Quechua apprentices that he works with, and it's a good thing for them, you know. So, yeah.
That's fascinating, yeah. And it's cool that they're, I guess, typically with a lot of these medicine traditions, historically, I guess they were quite women-focused, because they'd be working with, being able to work with the herbs and stuff like that a lot more. So it's awesome that you hear about people training more of the women, indigenous people. So I guess, like, with those changes in a place like in Peru, where they're adding all these other medicines in an area that may not have had it before, is that a positive thing for the region, or is it more just because of the influx of people to the area that it's a necessary change, or is it seen as negative to the cultures that have been there historically?
It kind of depends who you ask. You know, some of the locals in the Sacred Valley are like really not into the group, the hippie gringo influx. That's because there is a certain attendant degree of irresponsibility, and sometimes it can be kind of more a party scene than something that's focused in terms of ceremonial work.
Yeah,
so there's that, and I've noticed is the case in many of these places. You have people who are more, I'll say, Catholicized. they view it in a wary way. And then you have, you know, the tourists themselves and the people that show up and stay for a long time. And for them, ostensibly, they're doing what they're doing, and it may or may not be a good or bad thing. Mm-hmm. And then, you know, you do have these enclaves of locals that are kind of more intimately involved in a creative process of adopting and using these things as part of the exercise of their traditional spiritual practices. Mm-hmm. So, and that for them is obviously a good thing, you know?
Yeah. That kind of question of, or not necessarily question, but that tension between like party culture, as you say, versus ceremonial space versus even the rising of medicalization language, in especially with all the phase three trials happening with MAPS and Compass Pathways and stuff like that. With such a dichotomy like that, what kind of problems do you see kind of arising with that kind of thing, especially with medicalization language, just because that seems to be not necessarily that it has to be another layer of neo-colonial violence, but it seems like it ends up being exclusive away from these indigenous groups and science as us having the answers and figuring out how to do it properly instead of these indigenous people that are just praying. So what?
Yeah. Yeah, that's a, it's a good question. It's an important question. So my what I've observed from inside kind of the paradigm of research science is that a lot of the people who are in charge when it comes to these research projects, they've spent a huge amount of time working within, you know, these systems, and not only the institutional systems, but the systems of thinking that form this particular approach to things. So, you know, these guys with the PhDs, and bless them, they work hard, but they have been conditioned so extremely and completely over such long periods of time that what I notice happens is they get to a place where they're so kind of focused on what they're doing that they fail to give any view to a broader picture issues.
Yeah.
And in this case, you know, the broader issue picture is this issue of kind of indigeneity and what that means when it comes to the use of these medicines in the context of age-old folk traditions.
Yeah.
And there may be something in that that is actually necessary and crucial in terms of kind of digging ourselves out of the hole that we've dug ourselves into in terms of this civilization.
Yeah. And
so, you know, the thing that I've noticed is when I'm interfacing with people who are kind of part of the biomedicalization of these medicines, they don't have any sense of what I'm talking about, or if they do, they can just be kind of uncomfortable.
Yeah.
It makes them uncomfortable, and they don't even know why they're uncomfortable, but they just know they're uncomfortable with it.
Yeah. So, I guess that hyper focus. Pardon?
From my perspective, the challenges in not being chronically contrary to the point of being like an adversary to everything they're doing, because I will get into this space where I'm just a thorn in their side, you know. So
yeah, it's interesting having, like, especially I guess in what you've been able to, like, the connections that you have and the work that you've done, you're kind of in the middle of all of these different worldviews, and you can see all these different sides, but it seems like there's some fundamental miscommunication without some of these bridge makers.
Yeah, 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 and this is, you know, from within the, there's a challenge from within the interface with indigenous cultures to find a way to advocate for it in its own voice.
Yeah.
Now, ideally, what we would do is we would have them speak directly.
Yeah.
And that's one of the challenges. You know, when it comes to all of these conferences and stuff, often what tends to be the case is you have a couple of indigenous and then you have a whole bunch of people around them that are doing the interpretation.
Yeah.
Well, something's lost in the interpretation.
Yeah, absolutely. It's almost like playing telephone or whatever, where the message just gets skewed from every further person away from the source.
Yeah.
And this is something that... at the Spirit Plant Medicine conference I was at recently, Elizabeth Bast, who does work with Iboga, kind of brought up, and that, like, in places like Canada, actually, Iboga is legal to make like healing centers or like a therapeutic center. And they talk about it being amazing for withdrawal and blah, 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 and you can heal people. But she said, like, but what fundamentally are we missing when we're not including the indigenous polyrhythms and the ceremonial understanding and the whole context of a ceremony? How many different layers of not just healing, but connection can result? Because I think some of the problems with the medicalization is thinking that, like, especially with something like depression, that something is inherently wrong with an individual and you just need to take this very active principle like psilocybin and you can cure them, rather than understanding the malaise of culture that has allowed these problems to kind of precipitate up from from the
ether. Absolutely.
So I guess with all this, the fact that you have been doing a little bit of work with the indigenous down in places like Peru and Jaula is important to talk about. So, like, what is exactly what you're doing, but what are some of the things that you are working on with the indigenous in places like Peru and Jaula to really bring the indigenous voice, if you can say that there is an indigenous voice, but how to bring that more into work in this space?
Yeah. So first, I would say that there is an indigenous voice.
Mm-hmm.
You know, as to what that is, I really think, and people, I've had conversations with this about, will kind of want to argue or disagree around it. As to what that voice is, but I really think that the key is in listening.
Yeah.
Sitting down and spending time and just listening to what people have to say. And it could be very simple things. It could be someone talking about their childhood and how they grew up, or problems they had with money, or problems they're having with their wife, or health issues and stuff like that. So that's that's a good place to start, I would say, in general. And that's kind of what I've been trying to do.
Yeah.
As to, like, the specifics of what we've, you know, been doing, we set up this community center in the Sacred Valley, up above the Sacred Valley, to facilitate this apprenticeship work amongst, you know, the women Quechua working with our Huachimero. And there are other ideas, you know, around that. But it was just to give something to them. And who knows? Who knows what happens 30 years from now? Maybe it's something wonderful.
Yeah.
In Huautla, you know, we're facilitating this archival work, which is to really develop something that connects the Mazatec people to sacred history again. And where they come from, and gives them something to be connected to and proud of in terms of their culture.
Yeah.
So there's, you know, that work. And then for the curanderos themselves, the whole of the tradition is really in the velada.
Yeah.
So bearing witness to that and doing it in a really a clear way, where you're really paying attention and you're offering your attention to what it is, and you're opening yourself up to the possibility that something deeper might actually speak to you.
Mm-hmm. And is that kind of more what that indigenous voice is in that context? Like really listening for what that deeper thing is rather than assuming that you have all the answers?
Yeah, I think that's a lot of it. And I've had this conversation with people recently about the indigenous voice, and they're really kind of resistant to it. But I mentioned something that Dania Natalia said about the mushroom, that she wasn't the one doing the healing.
Mm-hmm.
But the healing was being done through God by way of the mushroom.
Yeah.
And that to me is a particular way of expressing their relationship to sacred plants and the divine that characterizes this thing I'm calling the indigenous voice.
Mm-hmm.
And listening to that and taking it seriously, like it might have something to say above and beyond what we think we know.
That's interesting. When I was talking to Mary Porter a few years ago, or I guess it was last year I talked to her, she she does, like, she has her own church in somewhere in Oregon for the use of peyote and stuff like that. But she was talking about, like, the idea of what indigeneity is isn't necessarily, like, you were born in this territorial area. It's more about facilitating that deeper connection with the silence at the root of experience and really letting more things come through that isn't about what you think, and really letting something come to you. And that, in that sense, not that necessarily everyone is indigenous, but everyone can facilitate a level of indigeneity in themselves almost.
Yeah. And that's what's kind of been emphasized to me time and again in working with curanderos, curanderas, huachumeros, ayahuasqueros. Is that, you know, they really, in the Andes, they want you to develop a relationship with what they call Pachamama.
Mm-hmm.
And that's the focus in the ceremonial work. You're making offerings to Pachamama.
So. That's interesting. And I guess with a lot of work with psychedelics, like you see these articles coming out, saying like, oh, one experience or more with the classic psychedelics, it facilitates more environmental or ecological consciousness. So with something like that and the understanding that indigenous people are often and pretty much the caretakers of the land that they have, and they do amazing jobs facilitating resilience in the area and such, is the role of this kind of work in the future, is it just setting up more retreat centers and stuff like that? Or is it more like what else can be done around it? Is it like sharing and facilitating growth in the areas and sharing seeds and what kind of practices can help facilitate this kind of work for cultures in a deeper way that helps landscape and community and culture?
Yeah, it's a good question, and I don't think there's a straightforward answer. it's something that if it emerges, and I don't know that it will here in the United States or the Western world, if it emerges, it's going to emerge organically, naturally, and I don't think we know what that process will be. I'm skeptical that more retreat centers is going to be a solution in that, historically, when retreat centers have tried to pop up, for example, here in the United States, it's been a great big mess.
Yeah.
There was this situation up in the Northwest where a guy was claiming that he had rights to legal ayahuasca, and it turned into a big catastrophe.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm not sure that that's going to be the voice or the way forward. I think there's a lot to be said for empowering indigeneity and for kind of empowering just the basic human condition.
Mm-hmm.
And in terms of our own culture, I think there's a lot to be said for reconnecting us to a sense of sacred history.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah, absolutely. That's fascinating. Yeah, and that seems one of those questions that you're right, that like there is no one way forward, but it's about actually listening to these people and then facilitating what what these people could use for themselves to
make
their culture stronger or whatever, even if that means making a retreat center in the States, but it not just being based around doing healing work, but more of nature connection or permaculture work or whatever.
Yeah. I think those are all ways of kind of, facilitating something organic. Yeah.
In areas like in Jautla or the areas that you were working in Peru, is there like steps towards those kind of things? Like, is there a lot of like permaculture work being done nearby medicine centers or anything like that? Or is it all?
You know, there's more of that going on in Peru.
Okay.
The valley. There's a couple of groups doing pretty good work throughout the valley and work that is connected with elders, you know, Quechua elders in that area. Mm-hmm. There's a woman that's doing great work in the Sacred Valley by the name of Carolyn Putnam. And then they have another training center for permaculture. It's a little farther up the valley, kind of probably closer to Aguas Calientes. And I've heard good things about them. So people are trying. You know, the enormity of the task is a little overwhelming.
Mm-hmm.
So, yeah. In Jautla, you know, it's interesting. I had mentioned this before. But when I was, you know, discussing some of this sort of thing with Inti Garcia, who we're doing the archival project with,
mm-hmm.
He was telling me that the, you know, the Mazatec people are, they're really not interested in politics.
Mm-hmm.
They're not interested in getting involved in it. What interests them is their families, the more immediate situation of the community.
Okay, yeah.
Human connections.
Mm-hmm.
So one of the challenges is, as listeners, we go up there with a lot of projects. We're project-minded.
Mm-hmm.
And when they encounter this in us, they just look at us and think we're kind of crazy.
Mm-hmm.
Like, oh, he's always busy, which is why I think the Velada as a container of kind of transmission is so useful, because what it does is it forces you to stop. You have to actually stop.
Okay, yeah.
In ceremony, you know, Natalia, she's quite fierce about this. I mean, I've seen her, like, literally grab someone by the hair, pull their head up, and force them to look at the candles. Or she'll, you know, look at you directly and be like, you need to stand up, you need to look at the candles, you need to pay attention.
Mm-hmm.
And so I think in terms of, like, work, the work of, you know, the real spiritual work of cultivating presence and attentiveness goes a long way.
Yeah, absolutely. And to not just get caught up in your head and all your distracting thoughts.
Yeah. You know, and I work with a lot of well-intentioned people around this stuff, people that have great ideas. But at times I kind of step back and I look at them and I go, well, you know, all this busyness, you need to actually be less busy.
Mm-hmm.
Like, that's important.
Yeah, exactly. Like, stop for a second and really, like, that's one thing. Even a long time ago when I had a back injury and I couldn't walk for a few months, that was the first time for me that I had that stop of momentum that I could see for myself. What am I actually doing right now? Like, what has been my momentum and how can I use that momentum in a better way going forward instead of just carrying on with it for so long? And it really acted to change my life. So I can imagine that these kind of practices, when they are in the context of listening deeply to that stillness, that can really set your path in a new context, because you're just holding space for more stuff.
Yeah.
I was wondering too, like, for a lot of these indigenous groups, like, obviously the drug tourism and shamanic tourism is at this point a little bit of an inevitable force, but what do some of these indigenous groups think about it as a tourist thing for themselves? Like, do they see it as like, why are Westerners coming here? Why don't they do their own thing? Or is it like they understand that it is needed right now?
Yeah. Well, the situation, I think, that the Mazatec is unique in this regard. You know, they have a certain kinds of like rules on their tradition. One of the rules is if someone asks for a velada, you're under an obligation to actually give it to them. And it's viewed as like, this is the way it was explained to me, as bad karma to refuse.
Okay.
So, you have that going on, you know, on one side. The other thing is they're also, very specific about someone is not to be, compelled in any way into the lada. So, for example, our curandera will ask someone when they show up, did anyone tell you you needed to do this, or did you come on your own?
Okay.
Is this your decision? And if it is their decision, then she feels an obligation to do it. And I've been like, I'm like amazed at their willingness to do this. I mean, I've seen Natalia do 3 or 4 velada in a week.
Wow. And she's like 94, isn't she?
Yeah, well, she's 86.
Okay, holy.
So, you know, and it's amazing. She doesn't even question it. She just does it.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, it's interesting. They feel a certain obligation to do it, particularly if someone presents themselves in a sincere way.
Mm-hmm.
Now, my challenge in terms of trying to, like, facilitate some of this for people is screening. You know, we're doing screening. We're making sure that the right kinds of people get up there, because it's healthier for them, the Mazatec. It's healthier for participants. It's healthier for us. It's a saner thing. But it is a challenge.
Mm-hmm, absolutely. So I guess with that, like, there's the ability to go down to a place like Peru or Jaula and have a experience like this. And then on the other hand, there is also the fact that there is the medicalization going on, and that there's MDMA for helping with PTSD and mushrooms and ayahuasca, and all of this is happening in North America. Do you think that it's important for Westerners to figure out their own context of doing this stuff, or do you think it's going to be more important overall to have a deeper understanding from these indigenous traditions that we can actually come up with a better way where we don't have to constantly be extractive of these cultures?
Well, I think these cultures, from what I've experienced, when you're receptive to what they have to say, they want to tell you.
Okay.
And the reason for that, I think, is they have some sense of the situation. You know, Western culture, that we're kind of up a blind alleyway, that we're in a position where we're compromising the health, well-being of the planet, and that sort of thing. So they seem to want to actually communicate this stuff to us. As far as our culture finding its own way with this stuff, the issue I see there is I don't think we actually know how to do it.
Mm-hmm.
We have some sense, and we're trying to integrate it into a clinical paradigm, and it's proving itself useful, and that's great.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, there was a book that James Hillman wrote 20 years ago entitled, "We've Had 100 Years of Psychotherapy and the World Just Keeps Getting Worse." So, you know, the situation from that kind of expanded perception, which is the eco-psychological perspective, is that this indigenous perspective may be useful in returning us to the roots of our own civilization and culture.
Yeah, especially with the fact that our own roots did have practices like these that have been, for better or for worse, lost to modern understanding. But to get back to there, I guess, requires a deeper understanding from people who do know what this stuff is in itself.
Yeah.
Very interesting. Yeah. there was the other thing that I wanted to kind of briefly touch on before the end of this, and not necessarily to go into super detail, because I know you're trying to remove yourself from, or not necessarily remove yourself, but not be stuck in the drama of this kind of work, is with something like the FDA therapy phase 3 psilocybin approval with Compass Pathways, what are in regards to what we've been talking about, like with indigenous people and problems or benefits that arise from this kind of tourism, what do you see as the problems or the good potentials of this kind of work being done?
What kind of work? Which work?
In terms of it being medicalized in like North America, do you see that as positive, or not necessarily that it's cut and dry, that there's positives and negatives, but like what are some of that you might see in legalizing like psilocybin over mushrooms or that kind of thing?
Well, you know, I can securely say that it's kind of inconsequential, at least for indigenous peoples, and how they're going about using this. Mm-hmm. Like I said, mostly for them, it's about family, it's about kind of healing their community. In terms of like the whole issue of Compass Pathways and the road towards biomedicalization of psilocybin, you know, it works. We know that it works for specific sorts of disorders. Mm-hmm. It's helpful for trauma. It's helpful for anxiety. It's helpful for depression. And so far as like what Compass Pathways is doing, I think if you take a step back and look at it, there's an inevitability to what they're doing in terms of it's very well financed. Obviously, they're well connected in terms of the FDA and government in general. Mm-hmm. The problem, my concern is that now they've created a situation where they have a very they have an incentive to prevent it from being legally available to folk peoples in self-healing and religious practice. Mm-hmm. So there's a challenge there in terms of to what degree is this an obstacle to human beings' right to freedom of religion?
Yeah. That's interesting. Yeah, because if it ended up being just under a biomedical, you need to have these conditions to be able to access it, it removes it from the deeper context that something like the Mazatex might see it as.
Yeah.
Oh, that's so many interesting things around all of this that seem to be in the purview right now.
Yeah.
So I guess wrapping up a little bit, is there any kind of last things that you think are important within this question of shamanic drug tourism and its potential positive and negatives?
Oh, yeah, I mean, it's a phenomenon. It's really ramped up over the last 10 years. Mm-hmm. You know, when I first got interested in this stuff, it was kind of this journey to the East thing where you were stepping into the unknown, and then there was no guidance as far as, you know, this stuff is concerned. Obviously, it has a life of its own. It's going to have a life mm-hmm. of its own. So far as like what we're trying to do, again, it has to do with listening through the, you know, listening to what I call the indigenous voice, and then trying to function in a way that really empowers it at a deep level mm-hmm. in terms of human experience in general.
Yeah.
So, yeah.
Love it. That's great, man. So I guess finally, my podcast is called Shifting the Paradigm. So some things that I like to ask people at the end of an interview is just kind of, if we do need to facilitate this larger kind of change individually and collectively to kind of facilitate this change of paradigm so that we can continue to live in the world, what are some things that we can practically do to help cause this change in our individual lives or collectively?
Yeah, I think it's pretty simple in terms of human experience. Earlier, we were talking about the busy mind. Mm-hmm. And I think finding ways to still the busy mind, finding ways and kind of spaces in our life where the sacred and divine can peek through.
Yeah.
Getting out of the way of it. Stepping aside in our lives and kind of allowing something to happen through and in us that's deeper.
Yeah.
And, you know, again, going back to this whole situation of like our project-mindedness, I think it can be helpful just to put the projects aside sometimes.
Yeah. Yeah, I guess when you have a project in mind, you have kind of means that you have an end state in mind with that. Whereas if you're actually listening, it's about what the process is and the journey in itself, rather than thinking that you know what the result is supposed to be.
Yeah, and it, you know, it takes a certain courage to be able to do it. But then I've noticed, particularly in this sort of like more engaged Velada work, that something comes through that really wants to help you out.
Mm-hmm. And do you see this kind of like happening? Do you think that we are on the correct path with this stuff? Do you see more people being turned on to the understanding of the indigenous voice and that we need to facilitate this in a stronger way for all people instead of just medicalization? Or do you think that we haven't quite got it yet?
I think we haven't quite got it yet.
Okay.
This is sort of, and some of that just may be native to human condition and what it is, mm-hmm. of what we tend to seek and find when we're sort of out there looking for things.
Yeah.
You know, it's a phenomenon now,
mm-hmm.
a psychedelic thing, you know, the psychedelic renaissance, it's become this resurgent phenomenon.
Yeah.
And everything that is in terms of what all zeitgeists kind of are, there's a certain edge of risk to them where individually the trick seems to be finding a way to navigate the waters without drowning.
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. Well, Chris, it was great finally actually talking to you instead of just over text. So yeah, thank you for that.